When you look at a massive automated factory floor or even just a modern skyscraper, there's this expectation of incredible complexity.
Oh, sure. I mean, it makes sense to focus on that, right?
Yeah, you picture miles of glowing fiber optic cables, intricate circuit boards, custom machine parts keeping everything running. We tend to focus entirely on the high-tech stuff, you know, the silicon, the software.
Right, because that's the flashy part of engineering. The code and the processors are what actually do the thinking for these massive systems.
Exactly. But then you open up one of those gray control cabinets in the basement of that skyscraper, and you realize something almost comical.
Yeah.
All of this cutting-edge technology, like millions of dollars in automation hardware, is literally clinging to a perfectly mundane, bent piece of metal.
It really is.
So, welcome to the deep dive. Today we are looking at a masterclass in industrial engineering that's just hiding in plain sight. We're pulling insights from our source material today, which is the Professional Guide to Denrails and Cutting Tools, to figure out how this one simple standard keeps the modern automated world from falling apart.
And it really does. I mean, this metal rail represents a profound shift in how we build physical infrastructure. It sounds almost too simple to be revolutionary. But without it, the modern supply chain and industrial assembly processes as we know them would just grind to an absolute halt.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we get into how you build a panel with this thing or, the very specific physics of cutting it without destroying it, we have to understand what it actually is and why it's shaped the way it is.
Right.
So for you, listen, if you've never looked inside an industrial electrical enclosure, just imagine a standardized metal mounting strip bolted to the back wall of the cabinet.
Yeah, and its defining feature is its cross-section. Like if you slice it down the middle and look at the end, it looks like a top hat.
A top hat?
Yeah, or the Greek letter omega. The flat base mounts to the cabinet wall, and the brims of the hat, so the two flanges sticking out on either side, they sit elevated above the surface.
And those two little elevated flanges are the secret sauce here. Engineers actually call it a top hat rail for that exact reason. It sounds like an industrial Lego base plate, really.
That's a great analogy.
Because of those elevated brims, you don't need a unique screw or a bolt for every single terminal block or a programmable logic controller you want to mount.
Right, because the components themselves are manufactured with spring-loaded clamps built right into their bases.
Oh, so they just grab onto it.
Exactly. A technician places the top lip of the component onto the top flange of the rail, pushes down against the internal spring, and then just swings the bottom lip over the lower flange.
And it just locks.
Yep. The spring releases, and the component bites down onto the metal rail.
You just press it on and snap. But, I have to challenge this logic for a second.
Go for it.
If I am building a power grid or like a factory assembly line, I want things to be permanent. If I want a piece of heavy machinery to stay put, I bolt it down directly to the wall.
Sure. That's the traditional mindset.
Snapping things onto a little metal rim feels, fragile. Wasn't it more secure back in the day to just bolt everything directly to the back plane?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the trade-off between absolute permanence and functional efficiency dictates modern engineering. Imagine the traditional method you just described.
Right.
Bolting individual components to a flat metal panel takes a massive amount of manual labor. A technician has to measure, drill, and tap threaded holes for every single device. You are creating permanent custom real estate for that specific piece of hardware.
And if that specific piece of hardware fails 10 years later, you're in trouble.
Exactly.
I imagine swapping a burned out relay means unscrewing it from the back plane, usually in some cramped dark cabinet, while trying not to drop tiny screws into a nest of live wires.
It makes future maintenance an absolute nightmare. You would often have to power down the entire control system for hours just to drill new holes if the replacement part had a slightly different mounting footprint.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The rail system completely eliminates that. The rail itself is the only thing permanently mounted.
Makes sense.
The components align in a clean, organized row, allowing for incredibly fast assembly. But more importantly, it allows a tech to pop off a broken part with a flathead screwdriver and snap a new one on in seconds.
Okay, so the top hat geometry solves the mechanical problem.
Yeah.
But a clever shape doesn't change the world on its own, The true superpower of this rail isn't its geometry. It is the fact that the entire industrial world actually agreed to use it.
Yes. And the name itself gives away the origin story. DIN stands for Deutsches Institut für Normung, which is Germany's national standards organization.
Right.
They originally developed these profiles to create a universal platform long before globalization really took hold of the industrial supply chain.
It's wild that Germany practically laid the blueprint for modern industrial standardization. But it didn't just stay a German standard. Today, our sources note, it is governed by an international standard, which is ENEC 60714.
Yes.
And the standard isn't just a polite suggestion, is it? It's like a rigid mathematical contract.
Oh, absolutely. It dictates the exact cross-section geometry, the material thickness tolerances, the specific bend radii at those flanges.
Wait, even the bend radius?
Everything. Even the exact 25-millimeter spacing for the mounting holes.
That's crazy.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, that rigid mathematical contract is what eliminates the need for individual dimensional verification. Think about the alternative.
Okay.
Without that standard, every time a panel builder ordered a circuit breaker from a company in Japan, they would have to spend expensive engineering hours verifying that it would physically fit onto a mounting rail manufactured by a company in the U.S.
It's like the USB port of the industrial world.
That is exactly what it is.
Before USB, you had serial ports, parallel ports, custom adapters for every single mouse and keyboard. It was total chaos.
Total chaos.
So if a procurement manager today is buying parts from five different countries, this standard saves them from that exact same headache.
Precisely. Without it, you would be constantly custom fabricating shims, milling adapter plates, or redrilling panels right on the shop floor.
Which sounds incredibly expensive.
It destroys profit margins and delays projects by weeks. Because of ENIE 60715, a procurement specialist can confidently source components from across the globe based purely on price and performance.
Because they know it'll fit.
They know with absolute certainty that everything on their bill of materials will snap together on that rail without a single modification.
That kind of universal compatibility obviously cuts the total labor cost of every control cabinet built worldwide. But, you know, building this universal Lego set hits a bit of a wall when we talk about sizing. Because universal doesn't necessarily mean one size fits all.
No, definitely not.
The sources detail several variations of the rail, and here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, while the general top hat concept is universal, the physical dimensions scale to accommodate different loads and spatial constraints. But the absolute undisputed king of the industry is the TS-35.
TS-35, so that's 35 millimeters wide.
35 millimeters wide, yeah. And it accommodates the snap-in mechanisms on virtually all modern heavy-duty industrial components.
Okay.
It comes in a standard 7.5 millimeter height, but the standard also allows for a 15 millimeter version.
The deep rail.
Yes, the deep rail. I was looking at the diagrams in the source material, and the footprint where the component actually clips on is mathematically identical. So why would you need a rail that is twice as deep if the width hasn't changed?
It provides clearance underneath the mounted components.
Ah.
A 15 millimeter deep rail gives you an elevated channel between the back of the component and the wall of the cabinet that is incredibly useful when you have to route thick bundles of power cables under the rail to keep the panel organized.
That makes a lot of sense. Or if the components you are mounting have larger rear housings that physically need a bit more breathing room to vent heat.
Got it. But wait, if I'm a procurement manager, standardizing on one single rail type like the TS-35 across my entire global operation seems like the obvious move to save money.
Sure.
Why complicate the inventory with the next size down, the TS-15? I mean, a 15 millimeter wide, 5.5 millimeter high rail sounds tiny. Why not just use the TS-35 for everything and simplify the supply chain?
Well, that introduces the cost of physical real estate. The TS-15 is specifically reserved for tight auxiliary circuits, where space is at an absolute premium and the components are very lightweight.
Like what kind of components?
We are talking about signal conditioners, which act as translators between delicate sensors and the main computer, or small compact relay modules.
Okay.
When you're building a secondary control box that has to fit inside a cramped machine housing, the TS-15 delivers a space-efficient solution. The larger 35-millimeter rail would just waste cubic inches.
Right, and you obviously can't stick a massive power supply on a tiny 15-millimeter rail. The physical torque would probably rip it off the wall.
Structurally, it would fail immediately. So the TS-35 remains the default for any primary heavy-duty rail, while the TS-15 handles the secondary compact signal routing.
Now, the sources also mention some legacy shapes, like the G-type, which is 32 millimeters wide and literally looks like a letter G, and the C-section at 25 millimeters.
Yeah, the G-type actually predates the widespread adoption of the TS-35.
Yeah.
You will almost never see a modern engineer specify a G-type rail in a new design today.
So why do they still exist?
They're manufactured today purely so maintenance crews working on 30-year-old factory installations can source replacement parts.
Oh, so they don't have to rip everything out.
Exactly, without having to rip out and redesign the entire electrical backplane of a functioning facility.
And beyond the profile shape, there is the metallurgy. Because you can't just bend a piece of cheap tin and call it a day. The material choices are hyper-optimized.
Very much so.
You have steel plane, zinc plated, or galvanized for handling the highest mechanical loads. You have aluminum, which is lighter and naturally resists rust. And you have stainless steel.
Right, and stainless steel becomes critical the moment you step into specialized environments. Food processing plants, pharmaceutical labs, or chemical refineries, they use incredibly aggressive cleaning agents that would dissolve the zinc plating on a standard steel rail.
Oh, wow. And you can even choose between a solid rail or a perforated rail that comes with pre-punched holes for cable ties.
It's all about efficiency.
The sheer level of optimization is wild.
Right.
So we know the profiles, we know the metals, but to give this some context, where are these things actually hiding in the world around us? Because I guarantee you, almost everyone listening is sitting within a few hundred feet of one right now.
Oh, without a doubt. Let's start with motor control centers, or MCCs, which are essentially the nerve centers of heavy industry.
What exactly goes on inside an MCC?
Well, if you have a factory with 50 conveyor belts and massive robotic arms, the MCC is the centralized cabinet that powers and protects all those motors.
Okay.
The DN rail inside carries the circuit breakers, the contactors, which are basically heavy-duty industrial switches, and overload relays, which are thermal safety switches that cut power if a motor gets too hot.
Sounds intense.
It is. It is a highly dense, high-voltage layout. If one of those overload relays trips and burns out, the rail system allows a tech to isolate that single device and swap it rapidly without disturbing the neighboring switches.
Right, because in an automotive plant, an idle assembly line costs thousands of dollars a minute. The speed of the repair is just as important as the repair itself.
Exactly. Then you have programmable logic controller enclosures, the PLCs. These are the computer brains of the automated system.
Right.
The DN rail allows software engineers to easily expand the physical hardware. If a factory adds a new array of optical sensors to the assembly line, they don't need a new computer.
And just clip something on.
Yep. They just snap a new I/O module, the input-output nerve endings of the system, onto an available section of rail in the existing cabinet, wire it up, and update the software.
It's the ultimate plug-and-play architecture. And you walk past these panels every day. They're in your office building's HVAC room, on the train you commute on, mounted next to the solar panels on your roof. The sources specifically mention building automation and HVAC systems. Those cabinets are usually crammed into tiny utility closets.
And those specific cabinets are often maintained by non-special building staff rather than dedicated electrical engineers.
Oh, that's a good point.
The DN air rail forces the layout to remain neat, clear, and linear. You desperately want an organized, easily traceable layout when the building's main heating controller goes down in the middle of a blizzard.
The application in trains is fascinating, too. The railway signaling systems use the standard TS-35 rail, but the sources point out a critical caveat. Any component used on a train has to be tested to EN-50155 standards.
Yeah, the physical rail profile remains exactly the same, but the physics of a moving train change the requirements.
Because of the shaking.
Exactly. The massive, constant shock and vibration of rolling steel wheels means the spring-loaded clips inside the components have to grip the top hat flanges with exponentially more force. The EN-50155 standard ensures those clips won't vibrate loose over time.
Yeah, you definitely don't want the logic controller for the braking system popping off its rail because the train hit a rough patch of track.
No, you do not.
And on the environmental side, renewable energy, like solar inverters and battery storage facilities, rely heavily on aluminum DN rails.
Right. The outdoor environment dictates the material choice due to moisture and corrosion, but the fundamental geometric profile remains the anchor.
Okay, so you've engineered this beautiful system, you've mapped out your layout, selected the perfect aluminum TS-35 rail for an outdoor solar array, and ordered it.
Good to go.
But here is where the theory collides with physical reality. The rail arrives from the supplier in massive, 2-meter-long continuous strips.
Yeah, it doesn't come pre-sized.
Right, it has to be cut down to fit inside the specific waterproof enclosure you're building. And our sources make it very clear that the moment a panel builder tries to cut this metal, they risk ruining the entire system.
It is arguably the most critical mechanical step in the entire panel building process. The physical quality of that cut directly affects the structural integrity of the final build.
But if it is just a mounting bracket, why does it matter if the end of the metal is a little rough? It's just holding a plastic box.
Well, a poorly cut rail leaves sharp burrs along the edge. On a basic safety level, those jagged metal burrs can easily slice open the hands of a technician reaching into a tight, dark cabinet.
Ouch.
But mechanically, a rough edge acts like a microscopic saw blade. When you try to slide a $200 programmable logic controller onto the rail, that burr will catch, gouge, and permanently deform the plastic spring-loaded clips inside the component.
Oh, wow. So you end up destroying expensive, sensitive computer hardware because you didn't cleanly cut a $3 piece of bent metal.
Exactly. Furthermore, if the cut isn't perfectly square, the rail will not seat flush against the cabinet walls or align with the enclosure's pre-drilled mounting pattern.
They'll be crooked.
The entire row of components will sit at a slight angle, placing uneven stress on every single connection.
So how do we cut it? The sources outline a few methods, starting with the classic hacksaw. It requires a fine-tooth blade, usually 24 to 32 teeth per inch, to handle the thin metal. It's cheap, it fits in a toolbox.
But relying on manual labor sounds like a massive bottleneck for a production facility.
Right.
It is incredibly slow. And the physics of a saw blade mean it cuts by abrading the metal, literally tearing microscopic chunks of steel away.
So it's messy.
Very. Even with flawless technique, a hacksaw will always leave a burr. That dictates a mandatory secondary step. Every single manual cut has to be followed by a technician standing there with a metal file, meticulously deburring the edges.
Now look, if I'm a DIY kind of guy or a panel builder on a budget, I'm probably looking at the angle grinder on my workbench and thinking, I can be done with this in 5 seconds. Sparks flying, instant results. Why can't I just use that?
The speed is tempting, but in a professional setting, an angle grinder is an absolute metallurgical failure.
Really? Why? It slices right through the steel.
It cuts using intense friction, which generates immense heat. That heat creates what engineers call a heat-affected zone. It raises the temperature of the thin steel flanges past their temper point, causing the metal to warp and distort.
Oh, I see.
Suddenly, those incredibly tight ENIEC 60715 tolerances on the top hat profile are completely gone.
The flange literally bends out of shape from the heat.
Yes. The abrasive disc also leaves a deeply distorted, jagged edge with a massive burr.
And sparks everywhere.
Right. You introduce a safety hazard, throwing sparks and highly abrasive dust into a workshop filled with sensitive electronic components. You save 5 seconds making the cut, but you compromise the standard and spend 10 minutes trying to file down a hardened, warped piece of steel.
What about cold saws or band saws? The sources note these use specialized blades with 40 to 80 teeth, often paired with a liquid coolant system. They preserve the metal's properties without warping it.
They do mitigate the heat issue beautifully. Because the liquid coolant keeps the cutting zone cold, the flanges don't warp, the burr is minimal compared to a grinder.
Okay, so that's a good option.
A cold saw is a fantastic utility tool for a general fabrication shop that cuts pipes, angle iron, and DN rails all in the same machine.
But if you are running a dedicated panel shop, a saw still relies on abrading the metal. It still creates metal shadings.
That is the secondary issue. Sawing creates swarf those tiny, jagged metal shavings.
Right.
In an electrical environment, stray metal shavings are a catastrophic short circuit risk. A saw of any kind is simply not the most efficient way to handle high volume, clean rail preparation.
Which brings us to the professional secret. If hacksaws require endless manual filing, angle grinders destroy the metal's geometry with heat, and cold saws cover your workspace in dangerous metal swarf, how do the top-tier shops get a perfect cut?
They abandon saws entirely and use a dedicated shear cutter.
Like a massive industrial guillotine.
Conceptually, yes. A shear cutter doesn't abrade or tear the metal. You slide the rail into a custom-shaped die that matches the top hat profile perfectly.
Okay.
You position it against the measuring stop, pull a massive lever, and a hardened steel blade drives down. It displaces the metal along a single precise fracture line in a fraction of a second.
And because you are fracturing it rather than grinding it away, the physics change entirely.
You get zero burrs. The cut produces a perfectly square edge every single time. There is no lateral distortion to the flanges because the die holds the profile rigidly in place.
That's brilliant.
The moment you pull that lever, the rail is ready to accept components. No filing, no deburring, no secondary finishing required.
It fundamentally changes the safety profile of the shop, too. Right. There are no exposed rotating saw blades, there's no heat, no sparks flying across the room, and completely zero swarf.
Exactly.
No metal dust getting into the air or the electronics. and the built-in length stops change the workflow completely. You aren't out there with a tape measure squinting at a Sharpie mark.
The repeatability is what drives the return on investment. A technician sets the mechanical stop gauge once, and they can rapidly shear 50 identical pieces of rail.
Wow.
Every single piece will align perfectly with the enclosure's mounting holes. It eliminates human measurement error from the equation.
That's huge.
Leading brands in this space, companies like Phoenix Contact, Wadmuller, Panduit, and Payapress, they engineer these tools specifically with high-strength steel blades and integrated measuring guides because they understand that a bottleneck on the shop floor drains profits.
So what does this all mean? If we synthesize the financial reality from our sources, the upfront cost of a specialized benchtop shear cutter is obviously much higher than a $20 hacksaw.
Oh, definitely.
But the math shifts rapidly. If a shop is cutting more than 20 rails a week, the tool pays for itself in just a few weeks.
That quickly.
Yeah, the ROI is generated purely in the labor hours, saved by not paying a skilled technician to stand at a workbench manually filing burrs off metal strips.
That is the exact calculation panel builders make when outfitting a facility. But, you know, this raises an important question because that calculation changes based on the environment.
How so?
A high-volume production shop absolutely requires a heavy-duty, lever-operated benchtop shear that can slice through thick steel and aluminum effortlessly. But consider a mobile maintenance deck.
Right. They can't exactly bolt a 50-pound benchtop cutter to the hood of their service truck?
No, they can't. For field work, they need a portable, handheld shear model that provides the same burr-free fracture cut, but fits inside a standard toolbox.
Makes sense.
Defining the daily cut volume in the physical workspace dictates which tool makes financial sense. But across the board, the shearing mechanism itself remains the undisputed champion for preparing Dion rails.
It is incredibly satisfying when a specific mechanical tool just completely solves a multifaceted problem.
It really is.
We started this deep dive looking at what seemed like a meaningless piece of bent metal inside a gray box. But we've journeyed from the absolute genius of the ENEC 60715 standard, which essentially saves the global supply chain from descending into custom fabricated chaos, to the very specific physics of a burr-free shear cut. It is a brilliant system. Thank you for joining us as we explore the hidden foundation of the industrial world.
It really is an elegant ecosystem hiding in plain sight. And before we conclude, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over.
Let's hear it.
As our technology becomes increasingly microscopic, as communication protocols go entirely wireless, and as software moves permanently into the virtual cloud, our physical infrastructure, the massive, heavy machines that actually pump water, generate power, and move the real world, still absolutely relies on a purely mechanical 35-millimeter-wide piece of bent metal.
That's a crazy juxtaposition.
Right. It makes you wonder, will the physical DN rail ever be replaced by some new high-tech mounting paradigm? Or is this simple top hat profile the permanent, unbreakable anchor in an increasingly wireless world?
Next time you walk past a massive data center, just picture all that abstract cloud computing clinging for dear life to a metal top hat. It really changes the perspective. Keep questioning what's inside the cabinet, everyone.